Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Work Podcast. I'm Kathy Taylor, U.S. Commissioning Editor at Work, and today we have the privilege of having two of the industry's most knowledgeable and most outspoken experts on the digital media ecosystem with us. They are Ariel Garcia and Lou Pascalis. This podcast is really ultimately about responsibility, namely how the media and marketing ecosystem can and should move to take more responsibility for how its money flows. Part of our discussion will be further analysis of the ANA's recent programmatic report, but also as we get deeper into an election year that will no doubt leave us swimming in specious content, we'll also look at why a shift to greater advertising support of quality content, especially credible news sites, isn't just the right thing to do, but is good for business. Both Ariel and Lou are now working on these issues day to day, so I'd like for each of them to start by filling us in on what they are up to right now. Ariel?
Sure. So I spent several months last year talking to people across the ecosystem. You know, having come from the agency side, I had a pretty, not myopic, but a little bit of a myopic view. I'll own it. So I wanted to hear from the supply side of the ecosystem and understand if their challenges are similar. And what I found was a lot of shared frustrations about opacity and misaligned conflicts shared across the buy and the sell side. So I founded a consultancy that is really focused on helping marketers achieve sustainable growth through responsible marketing.
Great. And again, it gets back to that word responsibility, right? I mean, you want to be responsible for the money you're spending. And that touches obviously lots of different constituencies. So Lou, tell us what you're up to these days that touches on all of these issues or immerses yourself in them, as the case may be.
So I wear two different hats. I am the chief strategy officer of Ad Fontes Media, whose mission is to restore advertiser investment in quality news journalism in order to ensure that journalism itself continues to thrive here in the United States and also internationally. Journalism plays a unique role in what I now refer to as the war on truth. And we've been underfunding it for quite some time for a variety of reasons that I'm sure we'll get into in the next few minutes. But that's very gratifying work. And it's exciting to meet with marketers and their agencies, talk about the challenges and frankly, the business opportunity that news represents for them, which has been consistent throughout my career. That's one hat. And then like Ariel, I started my own company last year, AJL Advisory, which is really designed to help marketers find winning narratives in the marketplace and tech companies to figure out how to translate their product or service into something the marketer needs.
So it's interesting, both of you are both inside the industry and kind of with a bit of an outside perspective as well. Anyway, just first quickly, I wanted each of you to explain why you've both been among the few and the brave to be outspoken about a lot of the problems that really make the digital media ecosystem rather fraught right now.
Fundamentally, I believe that trust is currency. And I have always tried to structure what I do and the impact that I have around the belief that doing right by customers, business, and society are symbiotic outcomes. As a human being, I prefer heavy lifting to running in place. I find short-termism and immediate gratification to be lazy and tedious. And so staying quiet about these things that really hold the industry back from making progress for the benefit of brands, for the benefit of publishers, for the benefit of literally just about everyone except for those that wield all of the power, that's not something that is comfortable for me to sit and relish in. So that's really what drives my desire to be outspoken. What drives my ability to be outspoken is, like Lou, the founding of one's own consultancy practice, right?
Oh, that. Okay, Lou, you're up.
Well, you know, I was very fortunate during my tenure at Bank of America where they would allow me to speak at industry events and rail on about the advertiser's responsibility to support news. And I got a lot of traction on the event side, but they were very reluctant as policy to have any of their senior executives speak to reporters. And so I was quoted a lot, but it was always an unnamed source on background. It wasn't me in an official capacity. And I think it was as much a sense of excitement as it was relief that when I set up my own company, I could finally actually talk to the press without having get it cleared through the corporate communications function. Having built relations with many of the same reporters that I wanted to talk to in the previous years by giving them, you know, in general information and back on the on background, it was easy to kind of bring those relationships forward and get stuff done. And I think it goes without saying that journalists would like to see advertisers support journalism quite a bit. So the message is not a hard sell. The question is, can you do it in a way that is additive to the marketer's aspirations and not just an eat your vegetables message where do the right thing? Because do the right thing doesn't get the CFO excited.
No, unfortunately, it doesn't. Let's start with a little more unpacking of the ANA programmatic report. I wondered what your feelings were on whether this is moving any balls forward, whether it's resonated, whether it's changing the marketplace at all.
Sure. I'll go first on this one, just because I worked with the ANA on the report. There are a variety of things in the report. And in fact, what actually made it to the report is even the tip of the iceberg on other things we uncovered. As far as what's moving, I think the fact that we uncovered that 21% of impressions delivered by the participants in the study went to made-for-advertising sites, those sites that, you know, typically appear on the bottom of a page in what are called chum boxes. You know, if your vision is blurry, you may be dying of insomnia. All these crazy, often medical things. The fascinating thing here is that, number one, MFA sites typically don't create their own content. They either use AI to scrape existing content, or they sometimes plagiarize outright. Often the content isn't even factually based. Frequently, it's not measurable. It doesn't contribute to your business outcomes. But 1 in 5 impressions on the study were going to these sites. And here's the thing that's most insidious from where I sit. What they do is to use sophisticated technology to actually spoof brand suitability controls inside of programmatic media by reverse engineering the keywords that marketers are blocking and then rewriting articles without those keywords. And so what happens in the programmatic engine, and this all takes place in a 30-millisecond round trip, so it's quicker than the blink of an eye, is in a very simple model, the Washington Post has great high-quality editorial at a price premium with some keywords that might be blocked. And XYZ.com, a site you never heard of, has the same story without the blocked keywords at a fraction of the price of the Washington Post. And then programmatic decisioning engine says, oh, let's take the cheaper one because it's actually also more brand safe. In fact, MFAs are taking money, and in 2023, we estimate it was $17 billion away from quality publishers. And the single biggest category of quality publishers that they're hurting is news publishers. And so there is action being taken there.
Yeah. Well, I think, too, that part of the report was really everything you think you believe about quality content is wrong, or a lot of it, you know, like private marketplaces really being, you know, bullshit at the end of the day. So Ariel, what are your thoughts?
I mean, I think it's interesting, right? Because the fact alone that of 67 interested participants, 21 were able to clear the hurdle, to me, that's the more problematic piece of all of this. The MFA is kind of the issue du jour. It'll be something else tomorrow. It was something else yesterday. The fundamental issue with all of this is the issue of transparency and lack of stewardship, lack of governance, and misaligned incentives, right? That responsibility absolutely has to start with the marketer who owns the budget, right? But at the same time, they need to establish the right expectations for their agency so that their agencies are working for them and not against them. So where we've gotten to now is this place where we're living and dying by cheap reach and vanity metrics. And as a result, these alleged bombshell reports come out and they don't feel like bombshells because I don't think anyone's actually surprised at what's happening. personally, I don't see a ton of movement on that macro challenge, right? The fact that there were that many brands that hadn't addressed the need for contractual access to log level data, for example, that's mm-hmm. troubling. This is not a new issue. For the biggest brands, those with the biggest budgets, they certainly have more sophistication in the way that they're governing their media investment. But it is absolutely troubling that there is still this large swath of marketers that can't even participate in a transparency study.
Yeah.
And the fact that there's so much reluctance on the part of the ad tech ecosystem to open up the hood.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail right on the head with that, Ariel. The primary reason that over 40 marketers who initially signed up to participate in a study dropped out was because they were informed that there were contracts in their supply path between publishers and SSPs, and in some cases between SSPs and DSPs, that would not allow those vendors to disclose pricing to the client. And, you know, having spent my entire career on the client side, I find that more than troubling. I find it downright offensive. You know, we have these, to your point, large companies have these procurement functions, which are really there to enforce mm-hmm. all of the policies and practices that the client expects. And yet, most of these marketers, two-thirds of those who wanted to participate, weren't aware that these contracts precluded them from understanding the pricing dynamics. And that includes, you know, things like kickbacks, which were probably part of those same contracts. Based on my previous experience with the ANA agency transparency study about 8 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't inspect how your supply path is structured and understand that there are dynamics that are opaque to you with regard to the money you're spending, that's a problem. And I question why you would want to be in business with those people. Look, everyone yeah. deserves to make a profit. I have no problem with someone making a profit. But there are incentives other than, you know, normal business profit going to a part of the ecosystem that would divert a decision away from the best decision for the investment of the client. That needs to be excoriated. That needs to be called out. And marketers need to stop doing business. I mean it. Stop doing business with people on the supply path who aren't transparent.
Yeah, well, I know we talked earlier about one of the recommendations from the report, which is that clients hire a chief media officer or its equivalent. I know, Ariel, you and I think both of you had some pushback, augmentation perhaps to what that role should look like. So, you know, Ariel, I'd love to hear your thoughts about that.
Yeah, I had a bit of a visceral reaction to this one. First and foremost, to be clear, absolutely, yes, it's important for marketers to take a more active role in the stewardship of their media investment. There's no argument from me that marketers have ceded far too much control over far too much money, not to mention they've ceded control of policy and things that really impact the way that their brand shows up and the risk that they're exposed to other parties. To me, this part of this is a trust crisis that just needs to be addressed head on. Agency relationships need to be reset. Otherwise, if you're going to hire a chief media officer because you don't trust your agency and you don't actually expect them to trust them to do anything else than handle that cheap reach media, mm-hmm. then why pay them for planning? Why pay them for strategy? What is the purpose of all of this? I don't think that's a healthy place for marketers. I certainly don't think it's a healthy place for agencies that are trying to do good work. So marketers really need to be in the driver's seat there in terms of resetting what they expect their agencies to do and to prioritize. They need to hold agencies to the media standards that they outline, and they need to do that work to check their buys. To that extent, a chief media officer makes sense.
Yeah, so I have a different view. I've never worked anywhere where there wasn't a chief media officer. And so when the question first came up, I was kind of shocked by it. I played that role in several cases. And I think it's a more nuanced issue where the role of a chief media officer, and, you know, I I've played that role for nigh on 30 years, has changed a lot. Up until 2001, you know, you were really doing planning. You were doing communication strategy. You were doing media planning, channel planning, and then doing a lot of vendor meetings with traditional publishers. As we got into the digital era, and as we started to use technology to arbitrate a lot of those investments, there were a lot of questions that needed to be answered. And very quickly, I think the questions that needed to be answered outstripped the marketer's skill set in answering them.
Yeah.
And so there was this sort of dissonance between what I want, which was largely based on legacy media thoughts and principles, and what new sort of dark places were created in the way we transact in digital. And programmatic blew the doors open on that. And I used to say that programmatic media would be the worst thing that ever happened to advertising, but the single best thing to ever happen to marketing. And what I thought was going to happen is we were going to get better and more immediate signal from customer intent and be able to serve that signal with ever more precise creative. But unfortunately, before we got there, a lot of people, sometimes well-intended, but oftentimes taking advantage of the marketer's lack of direction, created additional ways for themselves to make money at the expense of the marketer. When I started in the industry, you'll get a laugh out of this, 100% of my media budget went to media.
And, wow, what a concept.
Yeah, right? You know, all those publishers got paid. When I left, we were barely above 50% in 2021. When you look at the totality of taxes that come from everybody on the Lumascape chart, all the agency fees that are added on, some of the other costs that you had to pay for data licensing and whatnot, not only did we put money in the hands of people who were maybe not as sincere about supporting our business goals over their own business goals, we took it directly out of the hand of publishers who were trying to justify, you know, maintaining high quality output, whether it's journalism or other content. So it was like a double whammy for the industry. And you start to see that, you know, one of the statistics I like to quote about journalism is that in a 14-year period ending with 2021, so the first year of the pandemic, newsrooms saw a 50% decline in the number of people working in them. And we need more journalists, and yet the ecosystem is taking money away from publishers in general and news publishers in particular.
Well, yeah, and that gets back into like this whole cheap reach imperative, right? Which really just sends the money in troubling directions.
Well, actually, so like one more thing on that point, because I know we've been focused on the ANA report and what is in it, but another important thing on this topic is what's not in it, right? Because the ANA report also does not cover walled garden spending. So one of the things that I'm particularly worried about is some of the opacity creep that we're seeing in certain platform products, right?
Yeah.
I understand philosophically why AI-enabled products like Performance Max or Advantage Plus might be inherent to relinquish some control, right? Like I can, again, I see your face, Lou.
I think Lou disagrees.
I can understand the argument. Let me put it that way. Where you absolutely lose me is why it would also mean relinquishing transparency. It makes absolutely no sense to me. In fact, in order for those products to gain the traction that the platforms really, really want them to gain, they should have been leading with, we'll give you extra, like any level of detail that you require about where your ads are placed, we're going to give that to you. In the absence of that, you're literally just trusting black box algorithms to send your ads into the dark corners of the web, which, to Lou's point about quality journalism, this is only going to accelerate the trouble that publishers are facing.
So let's spend a moment on that if we can, because there was another report that came out around the same time that the ANA published, and it was actually a three-parter from a small company called Adalytics. And it was shocking to me. I'll just give you a very brief anecdote on what Ariel was just talking about. So Google was going around selling PMax as the second coming of Jesus Christ on earth. And PMax was essentially marketed as a tour de force of all Google platforms where they would optimize for you based on their black box algorithm, and you would be fine. Just trust us. Sounds good. And I've always found Google to be a reputable company. Now, if you read the fine print, it says we will also use Google search partners. And in fact, you can't opt out of Google search partners. So it turns out if you go over the Google search partners page on Google, the first thing it says is, we will not reveal the names of any of the vendors on this platform. And then it says, you cannot opt out of any of the vendors on this platform. So Adalytics did a very quick and basic study, and they found Fortune 50 ads running on Iranian porn sites. They found Fortune 50 ads running on sites that were blocked by the SDN, which is the government's list of don't advertise on these sites, and it's a felony if you do. And when they were approached initially, Google said, oh, these are very minuscule. It's a very small part of our offering. And as someone who sat in front of a regulator in my career, having to explain an action on a regulated company, it takes one screenshot. One screenshot. And it's the same with the investors or activist customers who might boycott your products because now you're running on these sites. So then as Google started to say, this is very minuscule, don't worry about it, they also revealed that there was no filtering mechanism on GSP. And if the three of us wanted to start our own company called KathyArielandLou.com, we could be a Google search customer, a search partner's partner by 5 o'clock Eastern time, you know, a couple hours from now when we're recording. So my point is this, to Ariel's point, when they engineer in a level of opacity that does not even allow the marketer to audit or determine, you know, maybe as a class, I would just like to avoid porn sites or sites the federal government said I shouldn't advertise
on.
Yeah,
possibly.
You don't have to name them. Well, you know, that would be nice, right, to have that option. But why hide that? Why not give the marketer the opportunity to defend themselves against that and put them in some significant jeopardy for something that's so minuscule? So I really question marketers who signed up for that, didn't read the fine print on page one of GSP, didn't read the fine print on PMax as Google was selling it as the greatest thing since sliced bread, and got themselves in a situation where now they're looking at some pretty terrible screenshots.
Yeah, well, just for a second, you know, just to synopsize about the programmatic report and the open web, just because they didn't include the walled gardens doesn't mean that they're they didn't include them because there's no problems there.
Yeah, so to add to the point about marketers not reading the fine print on products like PMax, the other challenge here is that, to what extent are marketers actually approving their buys at that level? Like, to what extent are they saying, like, oh, we're going to allocate X to X amount of our budget to performance max? I don't see that actually happening, right? And so the challenge is that if you're just approving Google budget as a line item or Google search budget, et cetera, that gives the agency quite a bit of latitude to determine whether and where to use performance max. Because what we're actually doing is conditioning marketers to not care where their ads run as long as they see the numbers that make them feel good.
Let's spend one more second on that, because Ariel, you're absolutely right. And I had the privilege of leading a large team at Bank of America, and we would do an annual event with our search partners, of which there was one, and we would bring the entire search team, of which there were like 35 people at Bank of America, plus, you know, the agency team, to a all-day session. And over the years, I noticed more and more and more senior people showing up from Google every time. And it was because my team, which was regulatory obsessed, would just start asking the questions that Ariel's talking about. I had the benefit of a large team that was very much expert in what they did. And, you know, they were SEO SMEs, not to mix the three-letter acronyms, subject matter experts par excellence. And it's very hard for smaller marketers as these things become more and more nuanced and more labor intensive to go into every single campaign and do what Simon says. Well, as you know, our T's and C's say that you can't do this. How do marketers keep up with the marketplace? And how do vendors actually make it easier for marketers to remain compliant and also support their own values and their own principles? It is becoming too labor intensive for us to really manage effectively.
And I also think that it's a big enough problem, and it's a growing trend. Again, I'm calling it opacity creep that pairs nicely with the acceleration of AI-driven ad products. It's a big enough problem that I would hope to see some dialogue about this that's being driven by the ANA and trade associations that are supposed to represent marketers.
But a black box is a black box. And there's nothing that the study could have done, and I worked very closely with the team, to say, hey, this black box could be bad. The focus was really on programmatic media in the open web. But the walled gardens are a philosophical problem for the industry when I think the open web and programmatic as it exists today to serve the open web is more of an operational and compliance problem for the industry. And so I think step one was to focus on where we could shine a light and then hopefully compel marketers to start asking these very same questions about the walled gardens.
So Ariel, what's your sort of first steps if you're a brand on moving this into a more positive direction?
Yeah, so I would say that the first step is really to secure and assess the degree of transparency that you have available to you. Everyone hates talking about contracts. Everyone hates talking about governance. Everyone hates talking about all of that stuff, but it's critically important. One of the ways I've thought about this that's more digestible, though, is I worry that in cases like the instance of Performance Max as an example, marketers aren't even aware where they are relinquishing transparency. So adjust your approval process. Require your agency to identify where placement reporting is not available, as an example. Require some degree of disclosure where there is no transparency in an ad product is an absolute starting point. Then you can make an informed decision. The other piece would be getting crystal clear on how your agency is compensated. I know that the latest ANA template kind of expanded the language that it used to try and catch all of these things, right? So it was expanding the way that rebates and incentives are addressed. But there's other places that these commercial models can hide. But it's important to understand what other factors may be driving your agency's recommendations of media partnerships, of media strategy, beyond what's best for your brand.
Lou, do you have anything to add? I bet you do.
Yeah, Ariel didn't leave a lot of meat on the bone, but let me give some specifics around the general themes that she talked about. Number one, make 2024 the year that you demand all of your log level data. So inform your agency that you expect log level data from publishers, from your SSPs, from your DSPs. They will tell you that X percent of them have contracts in place that don't allow them to share that data. Inform the agency that you will no longer do business with all of those publishers, all of those SSPs, and all of those DSPs who don't. Money will solve that problem. Now, the second thing is anybody can collect log level data, if you get the Seinfeld reference, but you need some professional organization to actually stitch it together. I worked with the group that did the work for ANA, which is a company called Fiducia DLT. It's part of the TAG, Trustworthy Accountability Group. And they actually built a tool that actually sees the hops and can show you where the problems are. There are other companies to do that for be sure, but bring in a capability. And I would recommend a vendor versus a new hire, because this is a very skilled function to analyze the LLD and continually audit it so that you're not opening up new windows as you close other bad ones, right? So I would set a policy that we're not going to pay anyone, any vendor that's not on our inclusion list. what's happening is, and Ariel, you framed this really well, marketers are just not taking the time to enforce their own policy. They have an inclusion list. They sweat it. I know we met every month to talk about it. And yet it's getting beat in the marketplace. These publishers should not be getting paid until they're on your inclusion list. That's a really simple one. You know, and I would do a quarterly review and say, hey, who are we doing business with? Do they reflect our values? Are there companies that keep showing up here that we should not be paying, that we should not be in business with? No MFA will ever show up on an inclusion list. Not one did in the ANA Programmatic Transparency Study, and yet they were one out of every five impressions delivered. So police your inclusion list and put some teeth in it by only paying people on that inclusion list. Get your log level data and have some professional organization analyze your log level data. Those are three very concrete steps that marketers should take this year.
So in terms of the news and fake news and the election and where brands sit in all of this, how do we sort of as an industry help support the news business? You know, first, you referenced a bit of this at an earlier time in the podcast, Lou, but first, from a business perspective, why that's a good thing. And then, you know, talk about also the role brands need to play in just making this essential ecosystem of journalism be supported.
Thanks, Kathy. I appreciate the question. And let me just start. The business case for news has never been stronger. When I started in this business, the most expensive piece of real estate you could buy was adjacent to the opinion page in the New York Times. You paid a huge premium there. And yet today, opinion has really polarized the electorate because it's been mixed in with news and it's eroded trust. It's caused people to kind of separate. We have this much more, this much greater willingness to be black and white about something. Somebody says something positive about a candidate. Oh, well, they're a blue state liberal. They're bi. And the same on the opposite side. But the reality is, when you look at the demography of who reads the news, the true news junkie, they have the most attractive socioeconomic status out there. Adfontes Media released a piece of research on this summer. I'll be happy to send you a link to it if you want to make it available to your listeners. But it showed overwhelmingly those things that really drive business, whether it's a number of postgraduate degrees in the household, number of trips abroad for pleasure, leisure. That was always a big indicator at American Express of a likely platinum cardholder is if they took two or more vacations abroad. That was probably your target, right? But also more likely to own an iPhone, which is always a big indicator of income. All of those things and many more are true about the news audience. So you're going to get significant return on advertising spend there because these are the people that buy luxury cars. And in our unfortunately two-class economy, these are the ones that the recession that we lived through, and which, if it ever really existed, is now truly over, kind of masked it because their consumption did not go down, where we've seen an 80% decline in advertising and news brought on by a number of factors, but largely a fear of getting caught up in the culture wars. News now represents significant unduplicated reach. And if you've ever managed a big budget for a client, unduplicated reach is the first place to look if you want to drive growth. People we haven't touched before, and news represents a very large opportunity for most advertisers today to actually grow their business in 2024. Let alone we're seeing big spikes in demand as people get ready, you know, for what will be the most contentious election in our nation's history, and hopefully not the last election in our nation's history. We are particularly seeing a growth in demand among younger cohorts, Gen Z, Gen Alpha, who are actually saying, hey, I'm going to return to quality news outlets in order to get my news and not rely on social media. That's wonderful.
Yeah, that's really significant. And I mean, there's been a lot of sort of jokes, if you can call them that, around, you know, younger cohorts getting their news on TikTok. But I think that's something that is really sort of has been unknown, has not been documented.
And I completely agree. I think that for journalism to thrive in the future, I was looking the other day, I think it was Google had filed some patent where essentially they're going to summarize results and not drive, again, not drive traffic to publisher pages. Like, the writing is on the wall for the sole reliance on advertising revenue to sustain quality journalism. With that being said, it's not a complete lost cause, right? And so one of the things that the way that I've been framing the state of the industry when I've been talking about it is that marketers are paying for bad data to reach fake people on unsafe sites while democracy dies. And it's interesting because even when we had this conversation today, we talked about like the first three pieces of that puzzle. And then we said, okay, let's switch gears and talk about the second piece, the part about democracy. And yet these things are all so interrelated. And so while that sounds like a really bleak thing to say about the state of the industry, it also is a really optimistic perspective, because when you look at it from that perspective, solving one thing, we're not asking, like, you know, Lou just spoke to the business case for supporting quality journalism. The reality is that the action items for marketers are equally good for their businesses and solving some of the problems that they have as a result of the like vanity metrics obsessed place that the industry's gotten to. Those same solutions also go to support journalism, protect democracy. So that's something that I actually find encouraging and energizing about the state of the industry now. So the positive thing in all of this is that what is good for marketers is also good for our society.
I agree. I don't think companies today at the highest level, at the CEO level, realize the role that they're playing in the decline of quality news journalism. They all exist in a particular market. Bank of America CEOs in Charlotte, and Bank of America had a special relationship with the Charlotte Observer, not to influence editorial, but just to keep the community vibrant because so many of its employees were there in the headquarters. And I think the more that we can forge connection between those local journalistic institutions and the companies headquartered in those local markets, beyond advertising, beyond the simple quid pro quo of the transaction that you're trying to foment, I think the better off we'll be, because the amount of money that is required to keep a local newspaper in business is relatively small compared to the budgets of most major marketers in the United States and most major brands in the United States today. And if every company that had a headquarters in a local market adopted their local news platform and created some sort of philanthropic mechanism. Most of these companies have huge foundations where they give money to a lot of other things in their ESG portfolio, their environment, their sustainability, their governance portfolio. But why isn't quality news journalism, particularly on a local level, a plank in that portfolio? We need to make sure church and state remain relatively separated. But we've got to find new economic models, and I think ESG is a bright spot that I'm optimistic about in the coming year.
Well, we're going to have to close here, unfortunately. I can't thank Ariel and Lou enough for this fantastic conversation, and thanks to all of you for listening to The Work Podcast. It's available on all of the most popular podcasting platforms, so subscribe if you don't already. Thank you.